Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news and their reporting. We begin today's show by talking about gun violence. Today's guest, Guardian reporter Lois Beckett and her colleague Darren Bond Graham, recently launched a year-long project investigating the dramatic drop in gun homicides in the Bay Area, a region scarred by rising inequality and gentrification. Gun homicides nationwide have barely dropped, but in the Bay Area, they are down by 30%. So what explains this? Joining us to discuss this investigation and media coverage of gun violence is Lois Beckett, a senior reporter at The Guardian who covers gun policy, criminal justice, and the far right in the U.S. In 2015, her Essence magazine story on PTSD caused by gun violence, called Black America's Invisible Crisis, won a Deadline Award for public service. And Lois joins us from Oakland. Hi, Lois. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Lois, I just wanted to ask you about a tweet that you pinned in November, and I wonder if you still feel the same way today. You wrote, "I am sick of media outlets making a case for hopelessness and stalemate after the latest mass shooting. There are ways to prevent some of these shootings, but people don't know about them because we don't cover them." And you put, "we don't cover them" in caps. Do you still feel the same way today?
We're trying to look differently. We're trying to look at the murders that didn't happen in a Bay Area. Just looking at the data over the past decade, in 2017 compared with 2007, there were 150 murders that didn't happen. And we're trying to understand what, to the extent that we can, what explains that, not why someone died.
And I also wanted to ask you, as a reporter who covers this issue on a regular basis, how do you explain, how do you report the daily gun violence that is happening in this country? Because we had Shannon Watts on the show a couple of weeks ago. She's the founder of Moms Demand. This is basically a grassroots army of mainly moms who spend hours in state legislature, sometimes up to 14 hours a day, fighting gun laws, fighting for more gun control. And I follow her on Twitter, and I have to say, the stories that she finds on a daily basis are just, I mean, they're so sad, but they're also shocking. She wrote about something that happened just a couple of days ago. There were two cars in Texas, and one car cut the other car off, and they exchanged words. They stopped at like a gas station, or they pulled over, basically. There was an 18-year-old in the car who had an AR-15 rifle. And once the dad saw the rifle, he got in his car with his wife and his two kids and drove away. Well, the 18-year-old with the AR shot into the car, hit fireworks, which exploded. And now his two small children are recovering from horrific burns. And this is just one of so many stories that Shannon Watts tweets on a regular basis. And I just wonder, as a reporter, how do you put all of these horrific events in context?
I think it's really hard to do. And one of the real challenges of covering the gun violence beat is that there has been so much focus on mass shootings and on school shootings. And these are completely horrific events. And, you know, obviously everyone wants to do everything we can to prevent them. But in terms of the number of people who are killed with guns in America, those high-profile events represent maybe 1% of the total number of people dying. And it's the smaller everyday events, some of which are fatal shootings, some of which are non-fatal shootings, that really drive America's gun homicide rate 25 times higher than other countries. And so there's this real need to shift our attention from what is most horrific and spectacular to what is most common. Because if we focus on what happens most frequently on the most ordinary kinds of violence, we're going to have a better chance of saving more people's lives.
Shannon also tweeted a new documentary out from The Atlantic called American Trauma, How the NRA Sparked a Medical Rebellion. And in the documentary, Dr. Mallory Williams, who's chief of the Division of Trauma and Critical Care at Howard University, said, quote, I see more gunshot wounds as a trauma surgeon here in the U.S. per week than I did when I was in Kandahar, Afghanistan. 1 million Americans will be shot in the next decade.
It's really hard to wrap your mind around sometimes all of these numbers. And, you know, one of the really important and hard things to remember is that about 2/3 of America's gun deaths, more than 20,000 a year, are suicides. Wow. So if we're thinking about the real toll of gun death in America, a lot of it is younger men and older men using guns to kill themselves. And gun suicides are much more likely to be fatal than other kinds of suicide attempts. And that's a real crisis.
Yeah, and then we also have domestic violence and gun deaths, which we covered a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to cover that again next week. Just quickly, what are your thoughts on that? Every Town has a piece called Guns and Violence Against Women, America's Uniquely Lethal Domestic Violence Problem. How do you think this is being covered?
Domestic violence is another one of those issues in which often it's after a mass shooting where it turns out that not always, but many times, the shooter in a high-profile event had a past history of domestic violence, of some kind of violence against women. And then we're asking, why didn't that red flag result in action? Why didn't, in some cases, that crime against his wife or his partner or his kids result in him losing his gun rights, as was the case in the Sutherland Springs church shooting in Texas. And, you know, that's the way that we often talk about it. But of course, not all domestic violence offenders turn out to go on to commit mass shootings. Most of them don't. But if we put more attention into understanding daily domestic gun violence, then that would certainly help other problems. And one of the things that's really striking in the research is that even though domestic violence, gun homicide is a problem that claims hundreds of lives each year, there's also just the threat of, being threatened with a gun by your partner. Even just having a gun in the house can be very traumatizing. So researchers encourage us to talk about the ways that guns are being used to threaten people and to make women afraid, even if they're not actually being injured.
Lois Beckett is a senior reporter at The Guardian. She covers gun policy and criminal justice. And if you have any questions or comments for Lois about media coverage of gun violence, what are your thoughts about what you hear and read in the media on this issue? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Lois, you and your colleagues recently launched a year-long series on the dramatic decline of gun violence in the Bay Area. This is one of the country's most rapidly gentrifying areas. And this investigation is called Guns and Lies. Why did you all decide to focus on what is happening in the Bay Area and launch this series?
You know, there's so much bad news about gun violence in America, and we are hearing about school shooting after school shooting. It seems like the pace of mass shootings is increasing. There are certainly cities like Chicago and St. Louis and Baltimore that have seen just horrific increases in the toll of gun violence in the past few years. And the national homicide rate over the past decade hasn't gone down that much. But we knew that in the Bay Area, that wasn't the story of what was happening, and that Oakland, Richmond, San Francisco had seen double-digit decreases in their gun homicide rates, that something in this region seemed to be going right. And it's really important to remember in the United States, because I think so many of us always assume that gun violence is getting worse, that it actually has gotten better, that the number of people killed, the gun homicide rate is half what it was in the early 1990s, that we are safer. And the Bay Area was a place that was getting even safer, that was seeing progress that wasn't happening on a national level. And we wanted to understand what was happening and whether what was happening here is something that could be replicated elsewhere in the country.
And just to give listeners some context, because we do air outside of the Bay Area, you write, a spiraling housing crisis has made it unaffordable for many people to live in the cities where they work. More than 30,000 people across the Bay Area region are now homeless, many living in sprawling tent encampments or sleeping in their cars. For each new millionaire household the San Francisco Bay Area has produced, there are at least four new people living below the poverty line. San Francisco's property crime rate has spiked to the highest in the nation. But at the same time, you write, with little fanfare, the Bay Area has seen a dramatic drop in its homicide rate, driven by a considerable decrease in deadly shootings. So you and your team investigated homicide data across more than 100 cities nationwide. And in this analysis, you used crime stats from the California Department of Justice and focused on homicide and gun homicide rates from 12 counties in the Bay Area. Can you tell us more just about the kind of background research you did for this?
So I think a lot of people, certainly in the Bay Area, know that homicides have dropped sharply in Oakland, that the gun homicide rate is down 67% in Richmond over the past decade, that in San Francisco it's down nearly 50%. But I think even in the Bay Area, among people who live here, there was an assumption that that didn't mean that the area as a whole had gotten safer, that maybe that meant that the people who were committing violence were among the thousands and tens of thousands of people who have been priced out of Oakland, who have been pushed out as Oakland and Richmond and other cities increasingly gentrify, and it becomes very difficult for working people to afford to live there anymore. And so the reason that we actually pulled data on more than 100 cities across the 12 counties of the greater Bay Area is because we wanted to know if violence was just being pushed around the region or if these decreases were real.
And do you report that in San Francisco, the gun homicide rate has gone down 49%, Richmond down 67%, Oakland down 44%. You write that gun homicide rates for all races have fallen, but the drop is largest for Black Bay Area residents, a 40% decrease. In the past 10 years, tens of thousands of Black residents have moved out of Oakland and San Francisco as skyrocketing rents and housing prices have made the cities increasingly unaffordable. In fact, your colleagues, Sam Levin. Yeah, he wrote a really great piece last week about how Square, the company that makes it easier for small businesses to accept credit cards, is moving to Oakland soon. And a lot of people are afraid that what has happened in San Francisco is going to happen in Oakland. And he reports that 50 years ago, Blacks made up, I believe it was 50% of Oakland, and now it's like 14%. I mean, the percentage has dropped drastically. So can you specifically talk about what you found about gun homicide rates dropping for Black Bay Area residents and what explains that?
Absolutely. So I think it's really important to say that nobody in the Bay Area feels like that this is mission accomplished, that the levels of gun violence here are acceptable, because they're not. And there are still many places in Oakland and Richmond where local residents don't feel safe, where there are gun murders and shootings so frequently that it deeply affects the ability of anybody to go about their normal lives. But at the same time, it's also true that the number of people who are dying each year across the region is down sharply. And the decrease has been biggest. There's been a 40% decrease in the number of Black residents who are being murdered with guns. Mm. And that's true across the greater Bay Area. And one thing that's really important is that we are talking about gun homicide rates per capita, so that this is not a case where there are a fewer number of people being murdered just because there are fewer people overall in the region. The number of Black residents of the greater Bay Area, looking beyond San Francisco or Oakland out to Antioch, Vallejo, Stockton, that number has held steady. So what we've seen in the Bay Area is about the same number of total Black residents and a 40% decrease in the gun homicide rate for Black residents. So that Black residents in the Bay Area are getting, it's safer. And that's the bottom line.
And you report that the risk of being killed with a gun is still 22 times higher for Black residents than white residents across the region. And you quoted Maya Whitaker, who's a 27-year-old foster youth counselor who grew up in East Oakland and still lives there. And she says the area is still dangerous for some people. It's the same trauma people are going through.
Yeah, I think media outlets have not always done a good job on reporting accurately on the impact of violence in communities of color. There have been real failures there. And so I think it's really important when we talk about this to try to amplify the voices of people living in communities as much as possible, and to be very specific about the levels of safety and the continuing incredible harm and trauma that young people and families are going through. But at the same time, it is also true that there has been tremendous work led in most cases by Bay Area residents of color, led by Black activists in the region, who have spent years and in many cases their entire lives working to prevent violence. And so it's really important not to understate the continuing toll of violence, but it's also important to acknowledge and lift up the work and in some cases what appears to be the incredibly successful work of local community activists and organizations who appear to be quite successful in saving some lives.
And to that point, so many of these violence intervention workers who are doing extremely important work, they told you that they're being priced out of their own neighborhoods where they work. For example, the executive director of the Oakland-based nonprofit Youth Alive says many of her team cannot afford to live in Oakland.
I think it's just tremendously shocking. The fact that people who are doing some of the most important on-the-ground work to make a community safer really cannot afford to live in that community anymore. Certainly not the only example of this problem in Oakland, but a tremendously stark one. And a question of, you know, as Oakland changes, as different residents are coming in, are the people who are serving the community the best? Are the people who best represent the community? Is the best of Oakland going to be allowed to survive as developers raise prices on housing?
Right. And I should say the name of the executive director of Youth Alive is Ann Marks. You also spoke with Wayne Clark, the executive director of the Oakland Impact Center. And he said that to the young men he mentors in East Oakland, it sometimes looks like, quote, the system or public safety cares more about the city now that there's gentrification and you've got big businesses and you've got dollars and you've got white people moving in. Before, it was just a city full of poor people and we're just going to let them kill each other. I think this is really important. Can you talk about what these youth mentors told you about youth and their perception of this money and Square, for example, coming to Oakland? And in Sam's piece, he said that these Victorians that went for like $200,000 a year 10 years ago are now going for $1 million. I mean, it's changing so incredibly quickly, but these opportunities are not for everyone. Clearly. I mean, the same thing is happening here in San Francisco.
In talking to Wayne Clark and others, he said that it was just tremendously difficult for the young people he worked with, whose parents and great-grandparents had grown up in Oakland, to be there and to feel like their city was not for them anymore, and that certainly there was more money and more opportunities and jobs, but none of those opportunities or jobs were for them. He told me about one young man he worked with who had been sitting in a car in his grandmother's neighborhood, a place where he had grown up, and had the neighbors call the police on him because they didn't see him as a longtime resident, which was the reality. They saw him as a threat. And so I think it's tremendously important to just continue to lift up these stories and these perspectives. Oakland has such an incredible political and cultural legacy, but if you push out the people who created that political and cultural legacy, that's a tremendous loss for all of us.
Lois Beckett is senior reporter at The Guardian, who covers gun policy and criminal justice. And you can find her latest piece, Gun Violence Has Sharply Declined in California's Bay Area, What Happened, at yourcallradio.org. Lois and her colleagues are actually launching a year-long series on the dramatic decline of gun violence in the Bay Area, one of the country's most rapidly gentrifying areas. It's called Guns and Lies in America. And if you have any comments or questions for Lois about gun violence and really just how these issues are covered, because the connection to what Lois and her team did, talking to youth mentors and people who are, you know, right in the middle of these areas that are being gentrified, but feel like these opportunities do not reach out to everyone, the people who've been there the longest, for example. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you live in the Bay Area, what are your thoughts on these issues and Lois's coverage? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, Lois, talking to you about these youth mentors makes me think about some of this national media coverage that's focused on the Bay Area. So many media outlets are focusing on the extreme poverty, the extreme homelessness, and they love to talk about the poop on the streets. And I feel like a lot of these pieces are very simplistic. They don't tend to talk about how we got here, because a lot of policies got us to this place. And they definitely don't talk, at least the pieces I've seen, don't talk to these youth mentors. What are your thoughts about how the national media tend to cover these issues?
Well, it seems like the national media coverage tends to reflect the perspectives of a very small number of very wealthy people who may not have actually lived here for very long. And obviously that's pretty frustrating for everyone. It's especially frustrating when news coverage of real crises and real problems reflect the feelings of the people who are largely responsible for creating the problem and don't acknowledge that. There certainly has been a lot of coverage about how wealthy people, some of them in the tech industry, don't feel safe in San Francisco. And certainly there's a lot of people who don't feel safe in San Francisco who feel that the situation on the streets is unpleasant and nerve-wracking. And it's really important to remember that is all real, but it can be possible for, in a city like San Francisco, for the property crime rate to spike to the highest in the nation at the same time that the gun homicide rate drops 50%. We tend to talk about crime as if everything that breaks the law sort of moves together, and that's not really how it works, that sort of property crime and other things like that don't necessarily track at all with violence and very serious crime against persons. And it's important just to remember that San Francisco is actually, in terms of the number of people being murdered there, much safer than it was a decade ago, even if it might be more likely that your car is going to get broken into or that someone's going to steal your cell phone. Right. And to acknowledge that just means being a lot more complex about who you're talking to and trying to understand the dynamics of who feels safe and who doesn't, and what safety is.
And before we end, let's talk about some of the investments made by cities like Oakland and Richmond. You report on tens of millions of dollars in investment in public health approaches to gun violence prevention. One of those approaches is a community-driven ceasefire strategy. First off, what, based on your reporting, what strategies are most effective?
So a lot of strategies that have shown good evidence. There is an independent research analysis suggesting that ceasefire in Oakland, which is a police-involved strategy, double-digit decrease in homicides in Oakland. There's also the Richmond Advanced Peace or Office of Neighborhood Safety model, which is now being replicated in San Francisco, in Sacramento and Stockton. And that is not a police strategy. That is a purely outreach worker-focused leadership program for the young men most at risk of committing or being a victim of gun violence. And both of those programs exist across the country in various forms and have shown real evidence of working. And one thing that's really striking, particularly about the Richmond model, is that it relies on formerly incarcerated people who have deep connections in the community, but also street reputations that come in some cases from previously selling drugs, and invest in them and invest in local people with real community ties as the only people who can really effectively intervene with the people most at risk and who can most effectively prevent violence. And so what's really striking across the Bay Area, and this is in a lot of different cities, there are different variations of outreach worker strategies, is that it's putting real money, not like $10,000, but tens of millions of dollars in hiring people from the community with real credibility and real connections to try to do violence prevention work, you know, not necessarily hiring someone with a university degree who's never lived there. And that's a sort of strikingly different model, particularly a model that doesn't rely on the police. And the data in the Bay Area so far, the big reductions, suggest that this is something that really needs more attention and perhaps replication nationwide.
Well, Lois, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lois Beckett is a senior reporter at The Guardian, where she covers gun policy and criminal justice. Lois and her colleagues are embarking on a year-long series on the dramatic decline of gun violence in the Bay Area. It's called Guns and Lies, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. We also want to mention that a 15-year-old named Davon Han was shot and killed in the Mission District in San Francisco on Monday. He was an active member of United Playas. This is a San Francisco-based youth gun violence prevention group. And in August, we are going to invite some of the members of United Playas as well as Youth Alive on the show to continue this conversation. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up after a break, we will discuss media coverage of the reported ICE raids that are expected to begin this Sunday in 10 major cities across the country. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of the reported ICE raids that are expected to begin this Sunday. The New York Times broke this story a couple of days ago, and they report that the cities include San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, New Orleans, Houston, Chicago, Baltimore, Atlanta, Miami, and New York. And joining us to talk about coverage of this, we're also going to talk about coverage of migrant deaths and the citizenship question is Cindy Carcamo. She's an immigration reporter with the LA Times. Hi, Cindy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. Before we dive in and talk about these raids, I just want to ask you about media coverage of ICE overall. And getting ready for the show today, I was reminded of a very long piece that ran in The Atlantic by Franklin Foer back in September, and it's called How Trump Radicalized ICE. He writes that through their union, employees of ICE endorsed Trump's candidacy in September 2016. This is the first time the organization has ever lent its support to a presidential contender. He writes, when Trump prevailed in the election, the soon-to-be-named head of ICE triumphantly declared that it would finally have the backing of a president who would let the agency do its job. He's, quote, taking the handcuffs off, said Thomas Homan, who served as ICE's acting director under Trump until he retired in June. He said, quote, when Trump won, some officers thumped their chest and as if they had just won the Super Bowl, according to a former ICE official. So what are your thoughts overall, Cindy, on how the media report on ICE and the changes that we have seen under this administration?
Well, I think it's really interesting. Definitely the rhetoric surrounding immigration has gotten very heated, and you know, President Trump, the Trump administration, has definitely made a point of making sure that the public knows that they are hardliners on immigration, both illegal and legal. And you see that with what's happening right now along the border with regards to asylum. But I think we also have to keep in mind that this administration has a lot of obstacles when it comes to being able to accomplish what they say they want to accomplish, right? I mean, if you actually look at the numbers, Immigration and Customs Enforcement removal numbers, it shows a different story. You know, under the Obama administration, the peak of deportations was in about 2012, and the Obama administration removed about 405,000 people during that fiscal year alone. If you look at the Trump administration, the highest year so far has been about 256,000. that is definitely pales in comparison to the 409,000 number. I mean, if his rhetoric is that they're going to deport, which is shown right now with his, the rhetoric is that they're going to deport or start to deport about 1 million people. That's going to be very, very difficult to do. Basically, Immigration and Customs Enforcement does not have the manpower to do that sort of operation or to begin that sort of operation. I mean, they can try. I mean, that's why you're seeing right now they're saying that they might deport up to 2,000 people or round up about 2,000 immigrants who are in the country without legal status who have final orders of deportation. But then if you look at the bigger picture, you have close to 1 million people, something about 950,000 upward of that, with removal orders in the United States. 2,000 people, yes, it's going to be horrible and devastating for those 2,000 people and the collateral arrest that would come. But if you look at it on a bigger scale, it's a drop in the bucket to that 1 million. Hmm. To me, it's interesting because the rhetoric doesn't seem to jive with what is actually with the numbers, with the apprehension numbers, and also with the removal numbers. So I think talking with experts, they'll say, like I've been doing all week, is that the numbers really don't matter. The numbers of apprehensions don't matter to the administration. What matters is the perception that they're doing something. And I think we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, about the perception that the Trump administration is trying to give is that they're hard on illegal immigration, that they're hardliners. But at the end of the day, if you look at the numbers, it tells a very different story.
This is really interesting. I think it goes in line with how this administration started the campaign. And I'm sorry to use this offensive language, calling Mexicans rapists. I mean, I just hate saying that, but it's important because, as you said, the language is very important. So do you think that what they're doing, I mean, the separation of the children is horrific, yeah, and we're going to talk about the deaths of children also. But can you talk more about the kind of the thumping of the chest, you know, this chanting the build the wall, the calling Mexicans rapists, MS-13. I mean, this is what we can expect over the next year and a half through the 2020 election. And what you say is really interesting, just about the rhetoric versus what they're actually doing.
Exactly. And I wonder if it really, matters to his base. I think it matters to a certain extent, but as of right now, it seems like it's working for him. So basically, the message is to his base is, I'm doing what I can. I'm doing the most I can to basically clamp down to restrict immigration, illegal immigration in particular. And to the broader, to the immigrant community, it's, be fearful. and it's working. I mean, you're seeing it. People are fearful. It depends on where you live, but, there are reports of people not doing different things, not doing their usual routine, avoiding driving, not taking their kids to school, things of that sort. And so it's kind of interesting because I think that the rhetoric is working to a certain extent. And even if he doesn't have the apprehension numbers, even if they don't get 2,000, if they get, a smaller amount, a smaller group of people, I don't think it's going to matter. I think that the crisis has already kind of begun, even without them going out there and apprehending anyone. I mean, I think it's, you see it on headlines in the media. You see it everywhere. It's so pervasive. It's hard to avoid, and so I think that he has pretty much accomplished that. And I think that this is going to be kind of like a running theme because it works for him,
right?
So I think it'll be interesting to see what actually happens this weekend on Sunday. How many people are actually apprehended, and how many resources? I mean, how much money is being spent on apprehending? Maybe not that many people on the IT really wants. So I think that is going to be something that'll be interesting to look at, because if you look at during the Obama administration, and I think that's a really big difference. The Obama administration had a lot of help from local law enforcement. Hmm. local law enforcement was almost, you know, for quite some time, you know, under different programs, different operations, they really did help out Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And now, under the Trump administration, you don't have that anymore. You have mayors and law enforcement agencies, chiefs and sheriffs in big metropolitan areas where a lot of people, where there's a big population of people who are in the country without legal status, you know, they're coming out and they're saying, we're not going to help you. And actually, they're pretty hostile to this administration. So that's a big difference. That's a huge departure from the days of Obama. Trump doesn't have that kind of cooperation anymore. The ICE doesn't have that kind of cooperation anymore. So that's why that's a big obstacle, because that means that it's going to be very difficult to be able to remove as many people as Trump wants.
That is interesting also. Is that because most of these mayors are Democrats? Is that why they worked with the Obama administration?
I don't know. Well, it can be very political, but I think also what happened was there were court cases as well. There were court cases that basically said, look, you can't have this kind of, which essentially boiled down to, you can't, local law enforcement agencies are not an arm of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They can't hold people for Immigration and Customs Enforcement under certain situations. If you look at, for instance, also in California, we've taken that even a step further, where you have, laws, California laws that are in place that are hostile to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That wasn't happening during the Obama years. I think that's one of the reasons why you had so many high rates of removals under the Obama years that you're not seeing right now under the Trump years. And you never know. Things may change, but I think that's why Trump makes a big deal and the administration makes a big deal about these rates. But really, at the end of the day, what is going to be the outcome? How many people are they going to be able to nab? If that is the mission, if the mission is to apprehend and remove people, really, it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are.
Because you have people like the Chicago mayor, new mayor Lori Lightfoot, who says that she's going to block ICE from accessing the city police's database. You have California Governor Gavin Newsom went online yesterday in a video basically saying, do not open your door unless there's a warrant. Do not open your door. Yeah. In San Francisco, Mayor London Breed says, call this phone number. I mean, this is happening across the country.
Yes, and that's a real departure from what happened during the Obama years. I mean, you didn't really see this kind of outcry from and hostility toward immigration policy as you do now.
You know,
so that's definitely worth noting.
I think this is so interesting, Cindy, because a number of journalists who have covered immigration for decades have gone on Twitter, like Auda Bogado, for example, who's a reporter with Reveal. And she says, you know, I have been covering this for so long. These problems with people going to the bathroom, a lot of this is not new. Are things more horrific under Trump? Definitely. Are children dying under Trump? Definitely. She says, but I have seen this. She said, where were all of you under Obama? What do you think of that line, that opinion from various reporters who've been covering this for a long time?
Yes, no, I definitely think, I definitely think she has a good point. I mean, I've been covering immigration for more than a decade. And, I agree with her, it's a lot more pronounced now, especially, like, for instance, with the zero tolerance policy. I think it was just so out there and there was such an outcry. But I think that we have to remember, and I think I said this last time, that, you know, this sort of thing does not happen in a vacuum. This sort of criminalization of immigrants, of communities, of criminalizing people to the point where it's really easy to be removed from this country. I think that's been a long time coming. You know, and I think that we kind of forget that history. That Trump didn't just happen in a vacuum, and everything was basically set up for him to be able to do what he's trying to do now. But he also has limitations, you know, like with the courts, for instance. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that this is all happening And yet he failed. He had a recently failed attempt to get a citizenship question on the U.S. Census, right? Right. He has yet to build his border wall, as he calls it, and to expand it. And so, you know, these are failed accomplishments. These are promises that he made and have not been fulfilled. And so now we have these raids that are going to happen. You know, so I think it's kind of interesting. You know, some of the experts that I've spoken with have said, you know, this is just a distraction. This is a distraction from failed accomplishments on the immigration front. And I think that some, you know, I've spoken with some people who are immigration hardliners, people who will believe in immigration enforcement and see hope with Trump and really believe in him. But even they have said, you know, hey, you know, we're going to be really disappointed if, you know, there's going to be a promise of raise and then at the end of the day he backs out like he did last time. So I think that there is a danger in all this rhetoric too, that I think eventually, maybe, perhaps, but it seems like it, people will see that, you know, people who support him, that, you know, his rhetoric is not lining up with what he's doing on the ground and with the numbers of apprehensions and the numbers of removals.
I wanted to also ask you about a piece that ran in the New York Times by Darlene Kuna. She's a freelance journalist and adjunct professor at the University of Florida. And she writes, ICE is Trump's main instrument for the dirty work of trying to make America whiter again. She wrote this in the New York Times. She says, ICE makes mistakes. American citizens can get caught in its maw, even white Americans. According to the Cato Institute, from 2006 to 2017, ICE wrongfully detained more than 3,500 U.S. citizens in Texas alone. In Rhode Island, ICE issued 462 detainers for people listed as U.S. citizens over a 10-year period. So there's that. And then we're also hearing reports about how ICE can also arrest people who are with those that they are targeting. What are you hearing from the people you interviewed this week about that?
Yes, no, that's definitely, the Trump administration has made no qualms about that in the past, about collateral apprehensions, collateral arrests, that if you just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, if they have a final removal orders for a certain guy, let's say Joe Smith, but Joe Smith is living in the same house with Will Smith, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say Will Smith, but just like someone else who's in the country without legal status, who doesn't have a removal order, that person can get nabbed too and kind of rounded up. And this is something that the Trump administration has you know, no qualms about. They've done this, and they've said that they would do this as well, that this would be part of it. So it might not just be obviously the 2,000 people who have orders for final removal, but it will also be people who just happen to be in the vicinity who are in the country without legal status.
Today we are joined by Cindy Carcamo. She's an immigration reporter with the LA Times. We're talking about the expected ICE raids that are reportedly going to begin on Sunday. So many cities across the country have launched Know Your Rights guides circulating on Twitter and Facebook in English and in Spanish. And if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of this, we're also going to talk about migrant deaths. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I want to talk with you about migrant deaths, Cindy, because, I mean, the reports that keep coming out, it just continues. I was thinking about the report last year from Reveal about these kids being given psychotropic drugs to, quote, calm them down. Their parents weren't even there to give people permission to do it. In the last month, we got horrific reports about kids not having toothbrushes, not taking showers, women being told to drink out of a toilet. I mean, just horrific stories. And I want to focus on these migrant deaths because, I mean, I want to give kudos to Democracy Now! For covering this extensively, and we're going to play a clip from them in just a minute. But Yasmin Juarez is a Guatemalan mother who testified before members of a congressional panel on Wednesday. And NPR covered what happened to her baby last August. And I'm reading right now from a piece from Joel Rose. The death of a toddler is renewing concerns about the quality of medical care that immigrant families receive in federal detention centers. 18-month-old Marie Juarez died after being detained along with her mother, Yasmin Juarez, at the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas. Her mom says Marie was a happy, healthy child when they arrived at the border in March to seek asylum, and then they were sent to Dilley. 6 weeks after being discharged, her mom says Marie died of a treatable respiratory infection that began during her detention. And so I want to thank Democracy Now! For this clip. This is Yasmin Juarez testifying before a congressional panel on Wednesday.
Immigration officials.
After the interview, the ICE immigration official asked me why, for what reason I had come to the United States. I responded that I had come for my child's future. But they practically didn't let us talk. And he said, in these words, you know this country is for Americans, that Donald Trump is my president, and that we can take your daughter away from you and lock you in jail. And I remember I just started to cry because I really didn't have any words to respond to them. To me, that is mistreatment. I'm here today because I don't want any more little angels to suffer the way Marie did, the way I am now. I don't want any more mothers or fathers to lose children. It can't be so hard for a country like the United States to protect children.
And this is more of what Yasmin Juarez told lawmakers on Wednesday.
All the hard work of these doctors came too late. My Marie died on Mother's Day, on the day that in my city, in my country, we celebrate Mother's Day. When I left the hospital that day, all I had with me was a piece of paper with Maria's handprints in pink paint that the staff had created for me. It was the only thing that I had left, just her handprints. The nurses had made it the previous day as a Mother's Day gift. There are days I just want to give up because for me, it is very, very hard to see so many children and for none of them to be my daughter and to think that I will never see her again or hug her or enjoy being with her or tell her just how much I love her. For me, that is very hard. You have no idea how hard it is to move forward without my little girl. They tore out a piece of my heart. They tore out my soul. And now I am suffering, and it is difficult for me to get up and move forward. I wanted a better future for her, to work hard and get ahead so that she could keep growing the way that she was. I can't do that now. I can't do that because she is gone.
And that is Yasmin Juarez, a mother from Guatemala whose child Marie died from a lung infection after being held in an ICE detention center. She testified before members of a congressional panel on Wednesday. Thanks to Democracy Now! For that coverage. I wanted to also ask you, Cindy, Kirk Semple of the New York Times went to San Martin, El Salvador to speak with the mother of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez, the 25-year-old man who died along with his 23-month-old daughter, Angie Valeria, when they were trying to cross from Mexico into Texas. And his mom said that the neighborhood was controlled by gangs and they just wanted a better life. He and his wife worked in fast food restaurants and they just couldn't make it. I mean, every person has a story. What are your thoughts specifically about the migrant deaths? As far as we know, in the last year, 6 children have been killed, have died in U.S. custody.
Yes. Well, I think what we have to keep in mind is that the places that these children are being kept are meant to be temporary. Some of them are meant to be very temporary. And also they were constructed or they were created with a different population in mind. It wasn't meant to be a whole, you know, these facilities are not meant to be for children or families. Really, it was built with mostly adult males in mind. So it was a different population, and it's because we had a different population immigrating not too long ago, mostly adult males, but things have changed, and the population is different now. And now you have very young children, you have mothers, you have entire families, and you simply don't have the... you just don't have the infrastructure for it. And so, you know, it's going to, I mean, unfortunately, it's not very surprising that this is happening, because that you're seeing deaths, that you're seeing people who are very ill, because these facilities were not meant for them. But the administration has known about this for quite some time. They've known since last fall that it was a different population that was coming to the U.S. and asking for asylum. They knew that it was children and families, and nothing has been really done to address that situation, to address that particular situation of facilities and having adequate facilities for these families.
And about 30 seconds, sorry to cut you off, Cindy.
Sure.
Based on the people that you have interviewed, what is going to happen? What will it take to change this? Because we're just getting report after report. Politicians are going there now. Lawyers are going in to report back. What will it take?
I'm not sure, to be quite honest with you. I think, you know, you had the outcry last year when we had the zero tolerance policy. Maybe something akin to that. But even then, I mean, as we know now, family separate, you know, kids were still being taken away from their parents, even without the zero tolerance policy. It's continued. So really, it's hard to know. I think that you're going to have some kind of similar outcry, but there's going to have to be someone watching and making sure that this does not continue. And I think that the courts are trying to do that right now by, you know, with monitors and things of that sort. But I think it's going to take more than that.
Cindy Carcamo is an immigration reporter with the LA Times. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there will be rallies tonight and vigils. You can find more information at lightsforliberty.org. This is Your Call. Thank you for joining us.